You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. I have quite a special episode for you today, not least because my mother, Anne Ingle, is one of my guests, but also because this is the last episode of my Roisin Meets podcast, as you have come to know and hopefully love it. Today's show is the final edition in the series, but worry not, I will be back very soon with a new look podcast. Might sound a little different to Roisin Meets, but it will still be focused on bringing you great interviews with interesting people in every episode. So stay tuned in early 2019 for our new show. I really can't wait for you to hear it. So back to today. And as I mentioned, my mother Anne Ingle is here to talk to me along with legendary Irish racing driver Rosemary Smith. She may not be quite a household name, but trust me when I say that Rosemary is a big deal. She's a female pioneer in the notoriously male-dominated world of motorsport, driving in the Monte Carlo Rally 8 times, winning the Coupe de Dame on numerous occasions, and competing in most other iconic rallies all over the world. My mother, Anne, co-wrote Rosemary's biography, Driven, which was nominated for an En Poste Book Award in the sports category this year, narrowly missing out to the equally deserving Cora Staunton, who you'll have heard on this show just a few weeks ago. I was delighted to have them both in to speak about the experience, but I had to start by asking Rosemary to explain why on earth Michael Fassbender called over to her house for a cup of tea recently.
Well, I don't know that I can tell you everything.
Come on, tell me everything.
Well, all that happened was that I got an email from somebody in England, and something, and the name Michael Fassbender came up on it. And I asked the girl who does it for me, Deborah, and I said, somebody called Michael Fassbender. And she goes, Michael Fassbender? And I said, what does he do? Oh, because she gives up on me totally and completely. And she said, he's a film star and he's gorgeous and he might be the next James Bond. And go, blah, 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 blah. I said, yeah, well, he wants to come and meet me. Oh, my God. So anyway, next thing, he was coming in from London.
Yeah.
And his PA, Connie, she was on again saying, well, he doesn't really want to meet you in a hotel or anything. So I said, well, tell him to come up to the house. That's no problem. So I said, is he fat or thin? And, yeah, no, because my house is so tiny that, you know, if he were fat, he wouldn't get through the hall door. So, oh, no, he's very slim and very good looking. So, anyway, the day came and Deborah was only totally in awe of this man. I didn't even know what he looked like, you know, but so she had to.
Rosemary, I wish you'd told me. I would have just like called by to borrow some sugar or something while he was there.
Deborah just called by as well.
Did she?
Yeah. But he arrived anyway on the doorstep in a grey sort of hoodie thing and runners and, you know, totally casual. And he had one of his director producer. He has a film company, which I didn't know anything about him anyway. So he was lovely. He came in. And
why did he want to meet you?
Because I'm lovely.
Well, that's true. But apart from that, he's interested in fast cars.
He races. Yeah, he races. Last year in America, I think he did about 6 races in a Ferrari. And, well, that was news to me as well. But he wants to do some sort of, I don't know whether it's a documentary or whether it's a film about, you know, driving in the 70s and 80s and that sort of thing. So he thought, aha, now this is the person to get in touch with. But he was gorgeous. He came in and we sat in the kitchen and we had a cup of tea and Alistair was with him. And Alistair is the producer, director man. And he was just lovely. And
how long was he there, Rosemary?
He arrived at 2:10 and left at 6:40.
So, flipping heck. I mean, yeah. There was plenty of time to text my mum, say, Michael Fassbender's in my house, and I could have just popped along. I love him.
Yeah, do you?
Yeah.
Well, he was very nice now, and he told me sort of a bit about him, not a lot. And he's married, and he's 41, and the wife is 29, and they've worked together on movies and one thing and another. And then Deborah, my next door neighbour, she arrived. And
what pretense did you have? Just like calling in? Oh, popping in?
No. I told her to come in.
Okay.
She was so enthralled by the door.
Right.
So she came. And my hall door has a little small pane of glass, a sort of coloured glass. And I said to her, when she knocked at the door, I knew she was there. And I said, oh, I must go and let Deborah in. And he said, no, I'll do that. And he got up.
Oh, my.
And Deborah always does. She puts her nose against, you know, the little glass panel. And I knew it was going to happen. And of course, he goes out and her nose is here and his nose is here. And literally, they were nose to nose with a pane of glass between them. Well, the laugh and the giggles out of them. So then, but it ended up, and he said, I'll have another cup of tea. I said, there's the kettle. Then the biscuits are up in that, and go and make your own. So he did, and he was lovely. And
so he's your friend?
Nah, I mean, then I had to sign a thing. Would I be something okay. on his? No, no, I won't be in the
oh, right, okay.
But I will do
help him out.
But did you give him a copy of the book, Rosemary?
I don't know.
Oh, God's sake.
No, I don't know. Now, in all honesty, Anne, was it before or after the lunch?
Of course,
I don't
after
know.
The lunch,
I have no idea.
After the lunch.
I can't remember.
Anyway.
But anyway,
well,
he knew all about it.
Now that
me.
My mother has interrupted into the thing, well, she is here on...
I'll let her talk.
You're very good.
She's listened to me for the last year and a half, gone on and on and on. So now she can talk and I listen.
Well, let's both of you talk, maybe, because the thing is, there is a good story about how this book came about. And Rosemary, first of all, you just wanted your story written, didn't
no,
you?
I
and
didn't.
For a while, did you not? Okay.
Not really. Sorry, Rosemary. No, genuinely. I thought about it, but I thought about it over the years. And then I thought, no, nobody would be interested in anything I've done. But you see, you've got to have confidence to even think about it. Now, for a number of years, as you've read in the book, I sort of went down to the depths of depression. Not depression as such, but just down. I couldn't go any further down. So then Paul Howard
yes.
got in touch with me about a book he was doing about Tara Brown, because I had raced against Tara Brown years ago. And we were chatting away. And then somebody else thought about it, and they said, you really should do your book before you sort of go 6 feet under. And I thought, well, maybe now I can. I sort of got my confidence back and that sort of thing. So I asked Paul whether he would do it. And he said, no, I don't have time. And I'm, you know, contracted to RT. And I'm one thing and another. And Ross O'Kelly, Carol, whatever. So he said, but I've the very one that... He said, I think would be perfect for you to do it because she's in your own age group. So I said, brilliant. I don't like old people anyway, but never mind. So I met this woman and she was just adorable. And that's how it all started, because if I hadn't liked her, I couldn't have done
no.
it. That was the whole point.
And I'd say if she hadn't liked you, she couldn't have done it as well.
I'm quite sure. Yeah.
But yeah. Anne, back to you then. So you met up. I mean, this was out of the blue. Paul had said this to you.
Well, Paul sent me this text message, and attached to the text message was an interview that Rosemary had done with Ray Darcy. So I looked at the interview. I said, God, she's some woman. But I didn't take any more notice of it. And then eventually Paul said, well, are you interested? I said, interested in what? He said, she wants a story written. You can do it. I said, I haven't ever written a book. How would I be able to do that? And he said, of course, you're the same age. He seemed to think that because we were the same age, that was all that mattered.
Yeah.
So he gave me the phone number. I phoned up Rosemary mm-hmm. and we arranged to meet in the Fitzwilliam. And in she came, looking her gorgeous self, this tall, glamorous woman. I was quite taken aback. And she produces a whole load of photographs of her with Bob Hope and Maureen O'Hara and all these people. And she talks and she talks and she talks. And I sat and listened. And she said, I want a coffee table book. But Paul had already put me wise and said, she's going to say she wants a coffee table book, but tell her she can't have one. So I said, oh, no, that's out of the question. I said, you know, I didn't know the difference really. But anyway, we arranged to meet after that. She said, we can meet in the RIAC, she said, in Dawson Street.
The
Royal Irish Automobile Club in Dawson Street, because I'm a member there and that's okay. So that's what we did. So every Tuesday at 11 o'clock, we both arrived.
On time.
Exactly, because that's one of her things and one of my things too. And we proceeded up to the restaurant where we sat and Rosemary talked. I put on a machine and she talked and talked and talked.
And Rosemary, did you enjoy this process? Like, you know, going
sometimes,
back in time? And
Sometimes. It depended, again, what sort of mood I was in or what had happened. But, I mean, I knew that because sometimes I was a bit hesitant even talking. Not that I minded talking about the ups and downs or anything like that, but just to myself, you know, if I didn't feel great or something like that. But, no... It on the whole, really. It was good fun. And, you know, I still ring her up now and ask her to come and have coffee with me. So she must have done something.
That's right. A good sign. Listen, just to let everyone know who doesn't, I mean, just if we can do a bit of a potted history. Your dad taught you how to drive, is that right? And that's the first sort of driving experience you had. But you were in a whole different career. I mean, you weren't that the best at school. You weren't into school. You didn't get on well with your mother.
Not really,
You kind of left school at 15. So
my father made sure I left.
Yeah, well, he got you leaving.
He was a Methodist and he wasn't going to have any nun tell him that his daughter was stupid.
Which she had said,
Which she had said, but she didn't actually mean I was stupid. I was stupid because I wouldn't try even to learn, because if I can't do something or, you know, I get lazed, though my eyes would be open, but I'd be sort of gone to sleep behind my eyes. So anyway, my father took exception to this and said, "Madam, if you don't think my daughter's any good, I'm taking her away." And he took me out of school that day, which really, I mean, it was so stupid. That was stupid because I'd learned nothing up to then anyway, but he should have taken me out of that and put me straight into another school.
Yeah.
But mind you, another school mightn't have taken me because I didn't even pass out. When it was out of kindergarten. You know, that's now how bad I was at school. I just didn't like it. And I didn't like, you must sit there from 9 to 12 and all this sort of carry on. I wanted to be doing other things. You know, I wanted to be either painting or drawing or playing hockey or playing tennis or doing something. But this just sitting doing nothing, it wasn't for me. And then we had one teacher who wasn't a nun, and she would come in the morning and she smelt of drink, cigarettes and cheap perfume. And that just put me off forever. And I used to sit there and I'd hold my nose. And then, of course, you know, because I was being very rude, I'd be put outside the door to say, oh, you know.
Yeah, it didn't.
It didn't work.
So you got into dressmaking. You went to the Grafton Academy.
Yeah.
And that, your life took a different turn. It was a very glamorous turn because you started to model and describe yourself as not as kind of shy person.
Very.
Even though you were this tall, very striking young woman, that didn't mean that you were kind of going around thinking you were the bee's knees.
No, I because I was so tall and because, you know, I'd been put down so often, you know, it was a cold up there and, you know, the snow on your hair and, you know, this sort of thing. Because my sister, who was beautiful, she was small and dark and long dark hair. And here I was this tall, skinny blonde. And, you know, it just, if you've no confidence, you've no confidence. And, you know, it's taken me years to get the confidence that I have now. I mean, if I'd been asked to do any of these interviews back, you know, even when I was driving, when I was all over the world, I was hopeless. I sort of answered yes, no. And the interviewers used to give up. Oh, this is just hopeless, you know. But that's how it was. Mm. I couldn't help it. And it was only after my mother died, because it started, when I was going around doing various things, I used to do television shows and, you know, Who's Baby and What's My Line and these things. And if my mother were on the show, and no matter what was said, she would answer for me. And with the result, I just literally, I would sit like this and say nothing. And the day she died, which is way back now, it's in the 80s she died, but I just came out of my shell completely. And then, you know, I got confidence. And
you did the dressmaking, you became a model, and it was because one of the people asked you to be a navigator. That's how you first got into the racing.
Yeah.
I mean, why did you go for that? Because that was a bit of an unusual thing to be asked to do.
No, because my dad raced a little bit and, you know, he was in the garage business and I knew about cars and I you know, used to go out to a few things. But, you know, I thought I could drive. I knew I could drive, but I didn't realise I was going to be a navigator. So when I started off, and after 3 miles, I was lost in the outback of Kilkenny somewhere. It was in a farmyard we ended up. And she was so annoyed that, you know, get out.
You weren't a very good navigator.
Oh, I'm still not. No. It's just that, again, it's just sitting there looking at a piece of paper or whatever the case may be.
So how did you get the driving thing then?
Because she was so annoyed. Because she only went on rallies because she was married and she had a boyfriend who rallied so she could get to see him. That was the thing. So she didn't. I mean, she could have said after the first time, forget it, don't come back again. But no, she said, fine, well, I'll drive out at the start, then you take it and drive the rest of the rally and then we'll stop down the road and I'll drive into the finish.
Okay.
She didn't want people to see Rosemary driving the car. She wanted her to look at it.
So when you got behind the wheel of the car and were driving, did you have this instant kind of feeling of, you know, this is something I want to do?
Yeah,
Yeah.
But I was in control. I didn't have to speak. I didn't have to sort of interact with people. And she was there to tell me where to go, and that was suited me down to the ground. So I didn't have to talk. But it was all came to light when I smashed her into a wall. And, well, she said, you know, it was 3 a.m., thick fog down at the back of Mount Leinster, and she said, we're coming to Crossroads, straight across. So I came to Crossroads, straight across, except it was a T-end, because we were on the wrong road. So we hit it rather hard, and she was sort of scalped. She lived, but she was very badly hurt. She'd 49 stitches around the top of her head. So, you know, at that hour of the morning, trying to get help, it was difficult. But, we got her, and we got her back to hospital eventually. But, you know, then after that, she was great. And her husband was great, because the husband knew she was having this ongoing affair. But he, at this stage, sort of liked me. And he wanted that I'd go on running. So he came down to the hospital in Carlow, where Delphine was, and she was unconscious, but she had all the stitches around the top of her head. She wasn't going to die, but she'd lost a lot of blood. And he took me home. But when I went out of the car and I got into the passenger seat like this.
Shaking.
Absolutely shaking. I was grand when it was all happening. I mean, I wasn't grand, but I didn't panic or anything. But anyway, so then he said, no, you're going to drive home. And it was only from Carlow back to where I lived in Clonee. And I think it took about 4.5 hours. And I was going about 3 miles an hour like this. And he was brilliant. And he, you know, if I was going into the ditch or something, he'd take hold of the steering wheel and, you know, pull it back around. And so went home, covered in blood, mostly Delphine's, not my own. And my parents, well, my mother nearly had a canary. And anyway, my dad, very calm, he said, right, into the shower, then into bed. And then that was fine. Next morning, got up, and he said, right, we're going down to, my sister lived at Bettystown at that stage. And got into the car, and again, he said, no, you're driving. And it was a Mini. It was very similar to the one that I'd crashed into the wall. And so I drove down, and I was only gone about 2 or 3 miles down the road, and I was back to normal again.
Right.
Absolutely.
That must have stood to you, Rosemary, for the rest of your driving career, because at any time after that you had an accident, you were able to just keep going.
Yeah, it must have been. That must have clicked in. Mum, you hearing about Rosemary's, you wouldn't have known much about, you can't drive yourself, I know. The only driving anecdote I know about you is when you went for a driving lesson and crashed into the back of a stationary bus. I remember that. It's a big memory of my childhood.
I shouldn't have stopped at that bus stop.
Yeah, okay, that's one way of looking at it. But anyway, you're not a driver. And then, so hearing all of, so then, you know, after that, the start, she carries on to have this incredible racing career. And for to be a woman, and I know, don't labour that point, but it was so unusual. And what were you like hearing all this stuff? Was it amazing?
She was telling me, like, she was only doing it because she was what they called a dumb blonde. You see, these people were trying to sell cars, Roisin, and she was just an appendage. But then when she started to drive and they realised that she actually had talent and she could beat the men too, well, her career took off. But when she was talking to me, when she'd say things like fan belts, like talk about eyes glazing over, and so I would have to go very close and be very stupid and ask a very stupid question. She was very patient with me and she would explain things. Like there was one incident where she was up at the top of a mountain and Jimmy Greaves came along. It was
Footballer.
London to Mexico, yes. Mm. And the fan belt was gone and he helped her fix it. But, you know, she'd throw it. Of course, that wasn't the first time. I fixed it before myself. I said, what do you mean you fixed it before myself? Yeah, well, we were in Portugal on that rally and the fan belt went. So I took off my stockings, she said, and I made that into a fan belt. And it was all over the papers. Rosemary takes off her stockings. So the thing was with Rosemary, she'd tell you one thing, but they would knock on to another. She'd never tell you anything like linear or straightforward. You'd have to keep dragging other things out of it. You know, it's quite extraordinary.
Going back on the race, and so for you listening to it as someone who completely didn't know, what was the most impressive thing or what were the things that really stood out for you that you were like, oh my God, I'm talking to a complete legend here. You'd go home and you'd be in.
Couldn't believe it. You know, sometimes she must be making it up. And I'd go home and I'd Google and I bought lots of books. I have a big stack of books in my house, you know.
About racing,
about which I had never had any idea. And I'd say, she has to be joking. It couldn't be that many miles. But no, there it was all was. And there was her face, you know, in a swimming pool on a boat when they had to get the boat from one place to the other. I then became really in awe of her, and I knew we were onto something. Mm. I mean, because after all, I was being paid for this, Roisin. This was a job for me. We had no publisher, and I was doing it, and I wanted to do a good job. And I said to her, Rosemary, we do about 40,000 words, Rosemary. And yeah, she said, that's grand. She didn't know the difference either. We were the blind leading the blind. She knew about cars. I knew a little bit about writing, and that's the way it went. But when I went to, I said, look, we've got to, this is a story. We've got to get this published. Oh, yes, that'd be no problem, says Rosemary, not realising that it actually is quite a problem. I went to Faith with what I'd got.
This is your agent.
This was came to be our agent. And
Faith, Lisa Richards.
Yes, from the Lisa Richards Agency. But she read what we'd done and she said, yes, yeah, that sounds... She couldn't believe this woman either because she knew nothing about the whole road. I think this is madness. And yeah, I said, well, it's all true. So Rose, Faith said to me, oh, we need about another 20 or 30,000 words. So I went back to Rosemary and she said, oh, yeah, we'll carry on then. And then she would tell me more things every time. I was amazed every time I went for these little sessions. It was an hour and a half every week, the stuff that I got from her, you see, because she wouldn't tell me anything straight up. I had to kind of drag things out of her.
You did not.
I did.
I never stopped.
She did talk.
And then, you know, then she'd say, she said, when did you get married? And I said, I don't know, I think it was 68. I'm not sure. So she comes back and says, you know, you didn't get married till 1970. Oh, really? What? No, I said, I don't think so, because that was the London to Mexico, which was 17,000 miles, 5,000 around Europe and 12,000 around South America and Argentina and, you know, up here, down there. So I don't think I would have had time to have gotten married in 1970. I didn't want to anyway. I really didn't want to get married.
Why?
Because I didn't like him.
Why did you marry him?
Because my mother kept telling me not to. And, you know, he's not the right person for you, which she was absolutely right. But if she just shut up and said nothing, you know, I probably wouldn't, because I made 3 appointments to get married, 3 things. And eventually, the third time, the priest out in Dunboyne, and he said, if you don't turn up today, that's it. I am not even going to contemplate you ever marrying this man. You obviously don't want to. And I said, no, I really don't. But anyway, then it came that sometime in August, and the morning I was meant to be getting married, I had no dress, I had nothing, no reception, no nothing. And my mother and father, my father came to the outside of the church, my mother didn't. But, you know, I went into town, into Switzers, and I knew one of the girls in the dress department. I said, quick, I need a dress. And she said, what for? And I said, I'm getting married at 11 or whatever time it was. And she thought I was mad anyway. And I bought a green dress and jacket, which I thought was, you know, quite smart, because I didn't care one way or the other. But I never wanted to. And then when we went off on honeymoon, we went with, there were 3 other couples and ourselves and one spare man who happened to be very into racing and that sort of thing. So most of the time I spent with him.
Mum, when you were hearing all this about, because I think you've mentioned your mum a couple of times and it really wasn't a good relationship, and in some ways very, well, obviously a mother relationship is very pivotal, and but in different ways perhaps than what we're used to hearing in the kind of chocolate box mother-daughter relationship. What did you make of how much of an influence Rosemary's mother was on, you know, what she did? Because it sounds like a lot of what you did was in sort of rebellion against her, or, you know, that you were constantly fighting against her because you just clashed so much.
Well, in the beginning, when after Rosemary had finished in the Grafton Academy, her mother went with her into the little business that they ran in South Ann Street. So they worked together on that, because she was...
In a dress designing area,
you know, bespoke dresses. And she was... They were good in that kind of thing, but they clashed in personality and it was never going to work. So she wasn't a support for Rosemary in many ways, I think, Rosemary.
No, you see, I think, again... She married, and after she married, she met this other man. And though, I mean, there were 3 of us, I often wondered how we ever came to be. But anyway, we came to be.
3 children, yeah.
And but I knew it wasn't, I mean, you know, they say, oh, I grew up in a very happy household. I can't say that, because there was a tension always. And then, you know, my dad would go out to work and then this other man would come in and, you know, and run along, children, go away and play in the garden and this sort of thing. And it wasn't nice, you know. I always had this feeling. But anyway, after my dad died, he was the first person around to my mum. And they did marry after that. And I was so delighted they married. But even then, you know, no matter what was said, you know, if I said, oh, we'll go such and such, and say, well, I prefer to go such and such, you know. And it was always like this. And no matter... It was just sort of a trait in her that I think she was unhappy. And then, you know, just one thing. And as I say, she would, you know, sort of answer for me. Any time we went anywhere, you know, she would answer for me. And
do you think that that fact that your home wasn't happy had an effect on your marriage and your things with other men after that?
Well, I think, but even before I married, I was, you know, I'd go and I'd meet somebody and then get engaged just to show that I could get this particular person. And I kept doing it time and time and time again. Just, I was proving a point, which, I mean, was ridiculous because I didn't like, there was only one that I really, 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 really fancied.
Is that?
Oh, no, I'm not telling you who that was.
I couldn't get that out of it.
No, listen,
I mean, all the success you had on the racing track, but Mum, one of the things you were, and we don't want to minimise, but you were kind of intrigued by these love affairs with famous men. So there was Adam Faith and there was Oliver Reed. So tell us a little bit about that. Mum, what was it like hearing about that? Because these would be people that you would have sort of known about.
That was one of the things that sold it for me when Paul said, you know, she had a thing with Adam Faith. And I said, oh, God, I have to meet this woman. Yeah, I mean, Adam Faith was somebody that pop star in our day. Rosemary, she was here in Ireland touring. And I don't know how she... Well, I said to her, how did you get him to look at you? Well, she said, I was very tall and he's very small. So, I mean, she stood out in the crowd. And then, of course...
She became a groupie.
She did. That's what she was. And then he said he liked the red hair on women. And
the
Irish women with their red hair
and freckles. So I went off and dyed my hair red.
Did you?
And and painted all these freckles all over my nose. Remember the way they used to sprinkle?
Yeah.
So, but it didn't suit me at all. I should have stayed as I was. But anyway,
was he like then?
Lovely.
Hang out with.
Oh, he was lovely. He was a nice little man, but he was. And then I had to wear flat shoes. So, you know, I have big feet, and then these flat shoes, and I was, you know, plodding along in them. But no, he was very nice. But, you know, after leaving him, he was living in the house that his manageress and her husband lived in. And I was asked to go across. He asked me to go across, and he was in a pantomime. And, you know, oh, I was thrilled to bits, and I went across. And then we were going to dinner afterwards, and then we were going to go back to this woman, Eve, to her house, and I was staying there and so on. And then I thought, because I thought in those days you got your own room, whatever. And then I discovered that I was meant to be actually in the bed that he was in. And I thought, oops. And I thought, no. And also, you know, I was terribly slim, but I still wore this sort of waspy thing to keep my waist even slimmer. And I had a bright green dress, bright red hair and freckles. So you can imagine the sight I was. But anyway... So we had the dinner and then went up to bed, and because he'd done two pantomimes that day, two shows, so he just fell into bed and fell asleep. So I thought, ooh, what's going to happen when he wakes up in the morning? So I lay on the bed. Oh, no, I never got undressed. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I thought, no, this is not for me. And then I got up, crept down the stairs, never thinking about, you know, burglar alarms or anything, out through the door, with these bells going all over the place, and ran up the road, got a telephone box, no mobiles or anything in those days, and rang my sister who lived in Croydon. And I said, Pamela, help. So anyway, I got a taxi, went back to stay with her.
That was the end of that.
That was
the end of that.
Wasn't it? I thought it was going on for longer, but she got cold feet.
Yeah, that's clearly what happened. And what about Oliver Reed then?
Yeah, but you see, now your mother really upset me. I nearly fell out with her over this. Because when I met Oliver Reed, he was single. He was doing a film down in a film, you know, a movie.
My mum is shaking her head.
No, I know she is. I know, but I'm still saying, still saying, Roisin, he was not married at the time. And his wife was not expecting a baby at the time. because I met the directors and one thing and another, and he certainly wasn't. But your mother insists he was.
Do you not think, Rosie, for a moment, that he might have been telling you little porky pies?
No.
You couldn't believe that Oliver Reed would tell you a woman lies?
He wasn't like that when I knew him. This is the whole point. It was after he became a hellraiser and he was a real gentleman. He was a lovely, quiet, very nice guy. He didn't drink all that much.
Where did you meet him?
In the Royal Hotel in Bray.
And you just, you had a chemistry with him, did you?
Oh, he was gorgeous. But then he was going back because he was on the way up now making movies, films.
He's actually going back to his wife who was pregnant.
No, he was not. I am telling you right now. So now, you see, this is the one we nearly fell out over.
Okay, we won't go full
now. No, we won't.
Did you keep in touch with Oliver Reed?
Yeah, I met him in London quite a few times after that. And I met Adam Faith in London a few times after that, because I was based in London quite a lot when I went driving with the Roots group.
And Rosemary, just in terms of the racing, what are you most proud of that you've done? Like, what is the things that you look back and you feel like, wow, I did that? What are the things that stand
out? Stayed alive till this ripe old age. Well, that's the proudest thing I did. No, there were a lot. I mean, there was like London, Sydney, London, Mexico, Safari Rally, which, I mean, there's no short rallies. You know, there weren't then. And the safari started in Nairobi. Terrible weather, the worst weather they'd had in so many years. And it went Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, and finished on the Tuesday morning. And out of, I don't know how many, went over 100. Yeah. But we were told by the people we were driving for that they had these big sort of kangaroo grills on the front. And if anybody got caught in the gumbo mud, which was thick mud, that just knocked them out of the way. Just drive at them and get them out of the way and you can go on to the next, which we did. So we finished. We were late. We were very late, but we finished. And it was very difficult because I don't know whether you've seen gumbo mud in Africa. It's bright pink. You know, it really is normally. But then this particular night, and it was the very last night, and the girl with me, Pauline, and we were driving along and suddenly I slam on the brakes and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "There's an elephant, look, a pink elephant," because the elephant had rolled in the mud and then it had dried off. So it was actually pink. And but there was no elephant. So she said, no elephant. And then it went on another hour or so later, another slam on the brakes, pink elephant. And Pauline, now this was during the night, I mean, it was really, you know, pitch dark, and then suddenly here are these elephants. And then another, about 2 hours later, here was another pink elephant. So this time I said, "I'm not going to be fooled now." I kept going, and Pauline said, stop, there's an elephant.
But you have to remember, Roisin, that this was day and night. It wasn't, you didn't just stop off in a hotel and have a nice sleep.
No, indeed, you didn't.
If Rosemary couldn't keep going, she'd let the navigator, you know, take a little while, but she really liked to keep into control. So it was endurance, actual physical endurance was tremendous.
Why were you suited to this? Why were you so good at it?
I was proving a point.
You were proving a point to your mother?
No, to myself at this stage. No, to myself as well.
What was the point?
Just that I could do something, that I wasn't just a ditzy blonde, you know, with long blonde hair and false eyelashes. And I used to wear them on rallies, big long ones, because when I got very tired and my eyes started to close, then I could see a fringe coming down. So I'd say, "Ooh, wake up again." Uh-huh. So that's why. I mean, it wasn't just because I wanted to look nice.
Okay, well, I need to ask you something then.
Yes.
If you were called Roger Smith and you had done all these things, do you think it would have been a different story in terms of what people knowing about you and knowing what you'd done? If you were a man, in other words.
Yeah, Roger was my brother. Yeah, and he was a very good driver, but he didn't get the opportunity. Now, you see, in one way, I'm going to go back to this thing being a dizzy blonde, because the man who ran the Roots team, his cars weren't very good. I did it privately the first year I ever did it, and this man saw me, and he saw the photographers from the magazines, you know, always motoring magazines, and he thought, my cars aren't winning, so if I have this dumb blonde and she can dangle her legs off the bonnet of one of our cars, at least we get some publicity. And he was the one who did it initially and he thought this would be great. But then the guys who were on the same team, they were cars were, you know, they just weren't fast enough and that sort of thing. But I, because I was in the coup de dame class, you know, and I started winning things. And then they suddenly realised that actually, you know, I wasn't a bad driver. So that it went on from there then.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, with all the things that you have done, up the Khyber Pass, reverse backways, this way, that way, all these rallies, Monte Carlo, huge deals. If you were a man who having an Irish man who had done all that stuff, do you think that the same sort of the idea that some people know you, because you say your name and a lot of people do know, but there's a lot of people who've never heard of you. I think if you were a man, there's probably be a statue to you somewhere on O'Connell Street. No, I mean, I'm just asking what you think about that, because I do think that's the case, because no other person in Ireland has done what you've done in terms of racing.
See,
is that am I right?
No, Paddy Hopkirk. But I mean, he was there. There were a few.
No, but do you not? Have you not done more than anybody
yes,
else?
Yes, I have.
Right, so I'm saying that. So here you are. You've done more than any other Irish person in this field, in this incredibly tough field that Mother has said is about endurance and all that thing. So why then? What do we not? Does everybody not know your name like they know the names of all these athletes and all these other people?
Because
Sonia Sullivan or whatever else.
Yeah, but you see, they all came later. Mm. I mean, even though I'm still competitive, but it's not the same coverage that, you see, if you have somebody running around a little track and either driving a racing car or on her feet or whatever, there are cameras going the whole way around. You can't put a camera all over the world. You can do it for, like in Mexico, they have their own station, but it didn't get back to Ireland or to England or something.
So there's reasons from that way. But what do you think, Mum? Do you think if she was a man that would be a different sort of legacy that we would know about?
Possibly, but the thing was, she was driving in the 60s and 70s when there was no social media, there's no internet. So obviously, the didn't get around as much as it did. So that would be a thing that was holding her back.
What about Ronnie Delaney? He only won one medal.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows who he is.
Yeah, but again, because it was the Olympics and he ran around a little track.
Yeah.
Just a thing, you know, that, and it bugs me. I know what you're saying, but
I'm wondering. What bugs you?
There was a race in Mondello during the summer, and there was a certain person, I won't mention her name because it's not fair, and the cameras were out and the photographers were out, and, oh, here she is, and she's racing in this big, big race and all the rest of it. And there was something like 21 cars or something in it. And all I could hear was, and here comes Joe Bloggs, or whatever her name was.
Joanna Bloggs.
Joanna Bloggs. And now, and she's, oh, I think she's going to overtake on this court. Oh, she's going to... So I said, and at the end of the race, there were three cars that were in the lead by about two laps. And I thought, she must be one of these three. And I was very impressed. So I said, where did she finish? She was 11th. Now, that I was annoyed. I said, fizz, or worse to that effect. But they made such a big thing about it. Now, I used to go out in Mondello, and I'd win, or be second or third, maybe. Oh, yeah. And in the paper then, the next day would be such and such a race, winner R. Smith.
R. Smith. So there wasn't anything at the time. No. The fact that you were a woman doing this thing in a very, very male-dominated field wasn't a thing.
They didn't care, basically.
Well, we're kind of redressing it all. My mother has written your book called Driven.
And the thing about the book, and the thing about Rosemary too, she told me all about this racing stuff and rallying, which I had to authenticate. But then there's her own personal story in the book as well, which there were times when she was telling me some of the stuff that I felt very sorry for, because she'd been such a had won so many things and been up there, you know, and then life took... You know, as it does, it deals us unfair blows, and the two men in her life had gone, and she was without money, and it was a really hard time for her. And when she was telling me about that, I thought that was all very, very poignant and had to come into the book. So, and Rosemary was very open to that, because she wanted to tell her whole story, her highs and lows and the whole lot. And she did. She opened up to me and told me all that, and that was a privilege I had. And I'm very happy to have written that for her, because, like that woman that she is, she came out of all that and went up again.
And the reason I did it really was because there are a lot of people who they feel like I did at one stage. There was no light at the end of the tunnel, none. and I was sitting in a house, no electricity, no anything. The house was going to be taken from me, and there was a little fish pond thing out at the back. It was a lovely place, and I'm sitting there freezing cold, and I had a dog one side and a dog the other side, and they knew instinctively what I was thinking, that a very easy way out would have been just walk out, go face down in that pool, and it would have been all over in a minute or two. And Blackie put her paw up and looked at me, these big sad eyes. Zach, the other side, did the same thing. And they knew what I was thinking. And at that point, I just said, I'm not letting these bastards get to me. I'm just not. Excuse me. And from that point on, I said, no, I'm going to fight back. I really am going to fight back. And it took, and that's why I say you've got to keep going under any circumstance.
But Mum, just you talked about there, you know, that fact that Rosemary went through such a dark time and but pulled herself out of it. So tell us about that. The fact that she sort of rebuilt herself again and got herself out of what, you know, like she was looking at the pond thinking, yeah, I could throw myself in and that would be it.
Of course, she was in such dire straits that she had to go on to what we call the dole.
The dole, social welfare.
You know, she went down to the local centre there, and a very nice woman who I think Rosemary's still friendly with today put her on the right road, and she had to go into the dole office, and she was very embarrassed obviously doing that, but she got that money. Well, it didn't last forever, because when she got on her feet a bit more, they took that away from her, but she wasn't happy about that, so she got in touch with Enda.
No, yeah, well, yes, but the other thing was that I, because, you know, of my ripe old age, I thought non-contributory pension, because I was away more than I was ever sort of in Ireland, basically, and they gave me €104 a week. And then after a while, they've, because my married name and Smith, they're two different names, obviously, but because then they said, oh, you know, you're working, you're self-employed now. So they took it away. So I don't have any pension or anything now. I get no help one way or the other. So, you know, I hope the book makes millions and then I can retire.
You did make a go of the driving school. I mean, that's that where your name is on that. And it was a great idea. It was something very original, very unique.
Yeah, but then, you know, I can't keep getting up at 6:15 in the morning. I mean, I'd be 82 in August, next August. So I think, you know, it's time I retired, don't you?
I think you deserve that,
You deserve a bit of a rest. And speaking of that, like both of you, I think, are a very good example of this. You know, some people sort of write people off once they get to a certain age. And women particularly, there's a sense that people become invisible and that they're not capable of contributing in different ways. Yeah. But you two are kind of examples. And there's so many examples. You're not the only two.
Oh, I mean,
it's such a myth and a stupid idea that, you know, aging means that you can't contribute anymore.
Well, I mean, they're talking about changing the retirement age and so on. Because I think a lot of people I knew through the years, the minute they retired, they had to retire at, say, 65 or something. And they were dead within 3 years. They were told, having had something that they got up for in the morning and they came home in the evening, that sort of thing. And then suddenly, what am I going to do today? You know, I have a friend now and she's absolutely adorable. She's nothing to do. And I keep saying to her, go and get something, even if it's a few hours in a boutique, you know, just to get out and talk to people and be with people. And it's very important. Because otherwise, you know, I mean, what do you do? Especially if you're living on your own and, you know, you don't have children around you and all that sort of carry on. But they're more and more and more, they're doing articles and programmes and so on about women over 50, but they're still all working. They're still doing this. They're still accepted. But, I mean, they weren't accepted. And the other thing, if you won't remember this, but in a certain jobs, the minute women got married, they had to resign.
I know, I was just telling
someone
about that last night. I was telling an English person American person who had made me repeat it three times because she actually couldn't get her head around it, the marriage bar.
Yes.
And Mum, what about you in terms of that sort of positive approach to ageing and the positive contribution people can make? I mean, you've written Driven, which is amazing, considering you never wrote a book in your life. And
do you know, I got a contact, somebody else wanted me to do their book.
You're
I might have
this
a new
is an
career.
Exclusive breaking news here. I didn't even know this.
No,
what? Really? Another ghostwritten book?
Facebook.
Well, I think that's amazing considering after you met Rosemary the first time, she went home and Googled how to be a ghostwriter.
Yeah. Oh, for goodness sake.
I love it.
Rosemary's aware of your inexperience. But you've written your own memoir.
I mean, currently just finishing editing my memoir. It's just a story from 1939 to 1980. It's a period of...
Quite a long time.
40 years, yeah. It's a time when I met your father and... well, it's time from when I was born and my experience in England and then meeting this wild Irish man, marrying him and subsequent happenings and the 8 children and just until the time he died. And unfortunately, he died in 1980. So it's just that story of an English woman meeting an Irish man and connecting and all the things that happened. Same way as I did with Rosemary's book. I'm going to go to Faith and say, look, Faith, do you think anybody will want to read this? And she's very good. She's a great eye. She knew we had a story in Driven. So if she says you've got a story, I will finish it and look for publication. And Rosemary doesn't read books, but I bet she'll read that one.
Well, who knows? Somebody might read it to her.
Maybe.
Yeah, we'll get the audio version.
Thank goodness that you've reminded me of that.
Okay.
Driven is out on Audible. Oh. Now, there's some people like myself who are a bit, their eyes are not so great. So to listen to this lovely woman, and she's a, well, I think she's from Rathfarnham, the lady who's reading it, but she sounds a bit like Rosemary.
Oh.
And it's really great. It's a great listen.
Okay.
So I was nearly tempted to listen to the whole thing myself.
You wrote it.
Even though I wrote it.
So what's next for you both? Maybe just what's next is you might take the foot off the accelerator.
Well, whatever I'm asked to do, and except I did say to Renault, because I'm an ambassador with them and they're asking me to go here, there and elsewhere, but I said I will not jump naked out of an aeroplane. I will not go and climb Mount Everest, no matter what. You know, there are certain things I will not do. But I'll go anywhere and I'll talk to anybody. And I have a lot of these women's clubs now that are coming on to me and saying, would I give a talk to them and that sort of thing, which I enjoy, you know, and go down the country. There's been quite a few of those have come in now and, you know, women's clubs and, you know. But see, women today, they're so different, Roisin. They're brilliant. I really admire them tremendously. You know, the women in their late 20s, 30s, 40s, and they're CEOs of companies and... they're not putting up with any bullshit from anybody. And they will stand the ground. You know, if you look, I mean, whether you like or loathe Theresa May, I mean, she is standing her ground, you know, whatever you think. Nicola Sturgeon up in Scotland. There are so many, Angela Merkel. They're heading up their countries. And if we could get rid of Donald Trump now and put a woman in there, you know, the world might be a safer place. But they are, because they can talk out, they can speak out, they're listened to.
Yeah.
I mean, we just weren't listened to.
And Mum, what about you, advice for people or things that you've learned from your long and varied existence? It'd be 80 in August, I have to say.
Yes, I will be 80. And thanks for reminding me. Well, no, I just think that the most important thing for me when you're dealing with life and people is to be tolerant and to look at the other person's point of view. And when you meet somebody and they might not be very nice to you, for example, you must always remember that you don't know what's happened to them that morning in their life. You know, that they could have had something bad happen to them. And to just embrace people and try and put as much love out as you can rather than condemning people without thinking about it. It sounds very trite, but love is a very important thing.
Love is all you need, as some very wise people once sang.
Oh,
it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Get away.
It's lovely to see your friendship blossom, and you're very different people, very, very different people. But you found each other at a time when you both needed in different ways to kind of get something. Because for you, Mum, creatively doing this project was amazing.
This has been such
It's been kind of life-changing at this stage of your life, which is interesting.
I mean, and the respect that I'm getting from so many people for having achieved this, it's just wonderful. And it's all down to Rosemary, because if she didn't have such a great story, I wouldn't be able to write it. Can you imagine?
If everyone goes and buys the book, whether on Audible or in print, they're going to have a great, rollicking, entertaining read of
it's
a life.
It's a good read. That's
it's
what
a we good read.
It's a good
and,
read.
And it's such an entertaining, interesting life that you led, and just incredible. You are an icon. You are a bit of a legend, Rosemary Smith. But Anne Ingle, you're a bit of a legend as well. And thank you both very much for coming in, and the best of luck with it. And the book is called Driven, and you're both brilliant.
Thanks a lot.
that's all we have time for this week and for Roisin Meets as you know it. Remember to keep an eye out for my new show early next year. And don't worry, we're going to make a big song and a huge dance about it beforehand, so you'll know exactly when it lands. Don't worry, we'll tell you everything soon. You can always find Roisin Meets episodes wherever you get your podcasts or on irishtimes.com if you want to listen back and remember some of our best ones. My favourites would be Richard E. Grant and Gay Byrne, but there's loads more to choose from, so do have a listen if you've missed any. Today's podcast and the series was produced by Jennifer Ryan with JJ Vernon on sound. I'm Roisin Ingle, and thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen to the new one too.